Good evening. I'm Paul LeClaire, and my job is in part to be the shepherd this evening and to get the whole flock into the Celeste Bartos Auditorium, and I think just about everybody's here, and we can begin. You're in for a real treat. Josephine Hart came to the library last year with some of her best friends from the theater and produced for us a simply stunning evening of poetry. And we're blessed that she's come back this evening for round two with more actors and different actors, Dame Eileen Atkins and Edward Herman, whom she will be introducing, are here with us this evening. This is, as you may know, National Poetry Month, and the New York Public Library has an immense commitment to poetry itself as a form of literary expression and has one of the single greatest collections anywhere of works, particularly by American and by English poets and Irish poets as well. And you'll be hearing works that were written by T.S. Eliot, an American who made his career in England. But what's special about Eliot for us at the library is that we have in the Berg Collection the manuscript of The Wasteland, his great masterpiece, with corrections by Ezra Pound, and you can see everything that Pound struck out and that Eliot left struck out. It is one of the single most important literary documents in the New York Public Library's absolutely brilliant collections. And we're very proud of the coincidence that Eliot has been chosen as the poet who will be read and presented tonight. Let me take a moment to thank all of you for not only being here in the Celeste Bartos Auditorium, but also for being such devoted friends and sponsors and conservators of the New York Public Library. Being a member of the Conservators Group at the library and the leadership group of it, the Council of Conservators, is immensely important to the library's future. We are in the strongest position we've ever been in our history, I think, in terms of our service to the public these days. We have more people using the library than I think in all of its history. In the last 12 months, we have had 17.5 million physical visits to the 91 units that make up the New York Public Library system. We have had about 30 million electronic visits. The number of visitors to our libraries are up by 12%, and the number of loans that are being checked out are up by 18%. And in the Bronx, where there are virtually no bookstores, our loans are up by 30%. Now, people are using this library in all kinds of different ways, and especially given the hard economic times that we're in, more and more people are coming to us for help in finding jobs. We're very proud of the fact that Barack Obama got his job in Chicago as a community organizer by coming to the New York Public Library, the Mid-Manhattan Library across the street, and a wonderful librarian there, this is before the days of online job searching, a wonderful librarian there opened for him a listing of all the organizations in Chicago to which he could write, and he is on the record as having given her and this library credit for helping him get his start. Now, we're helping people continuously at the library. That's our mission. That's our goal, and we do it continuously for free. But the research libraries in particular depend almost entirely, at least for two-thirds of their operating budget and their support, from the private sector. And many of you have heard me say this before, but sometimes I think that this library in particular at Fifth Avenue is misnamed. It should be called the New York Private Library, open to the public for free as a consequence of private giving. So I'm very pleased that my wife, Judith Ginsburg, and I are conservators. I'm pleased that so many of you are here this evening as conservators. If you're here as a guest, and I met a few guests earlier, think about joining us. This is one of the greatest, greatest cultural organizations that there is. And what's special about it and immensely dignified and noble about its mission is that we bring one of the greatest treasure houses of materials ever accumulated in all of history to the single broadest public imaginable, completely for free, and basically with no questions asked. So if you are inclined to help us, I would love it. Talk to me afterwards, or any one of the staff members here, or talk to the wonderful, wonderful co-chairs of the Council of Conservators, Susan Morgenthau, Robin McNeil, and Missy Rennie Taylor, who are also here this evening. I know Susan and Missy are here. If you could put your hands up. There's Missy. Here's Susan. Robin, I don't know if you're here. Well, see these two, see me, see any one of the staff members around, and we'll tell you how to become an even better friend of the New York Public Library than you may already be. and you'll help us buy books, pay staff, and help people find jobs. And now to our program. Josephine Hart's program this evening debuted in Cambridge last week at Harvard University, where it was a stunning success. And now it's come to the Big Apple for its presentation here at the New York Public Library, another part of 42nd Street, if not exactly Broadway. Josephine Hart is one of the most remarkable creative artists and writers that I know. She's the author of Damage, Sin, Oblivion, The Stillest Day, and The Reconstructionist. Her work has been translated into 27 different languages. Her next book, a novel entitled The Truth About Love, will be released in September by Knopf Publishing Group. Josephine has been a determined Pied Piper on behalf of her great love, poetry, having founded the Gallery Poets and West End Poetry Hour series in the UK, which presented the works of major poets read by some of British finest actors. She brought her special talents 4 years ago to the British Library, where she continues to present her marvelous Josephine Hart Poetry Hour series to standing room only audiences. She presented this program last weekend, as I said, at Harvard, and we're really lucky that she and her team of marvelous actors have joined us this evening. And so, ladies and gentlemen, and conservators-to-be, please welcome Josephine Hart, Dame Eileen Atkins, and Edward Herman.
Thank you, darling. Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. And thank you, Paul, if I may, for those wonderful words of welcome. It's got a special note to be welcomed with such enthusiasm the second time around. My most sincere gratitude, of course, to Kathy Rayner, trustee, to the co-chairs, Missy Rennie Taylor and Susan Morgenthau. And a special thank you to Catherine Kelly, whose transatlantic guidance has been as unstinting as it has been super efficient. Paul very kindly explained what it is that we're trying to do, and over the last 4 or 5 years, all our actors read for no fee, and because of their dedication to this project, we were able to publish Catching Life by the Throat in 2006, and it was published in this country by Norton. And in November of last year, we published Words That Burn. And with both of those books, the first one we funded free of charge into every school in the country, teaching between 12 and 18-year-olds, with the CD in the book on which the late, great Harold Pinter reads Larkin, Roger Moore reads Kipling, Ray Fiennes reads Auden, and on Words That Burn, Eileen, with Edward Fox, reads the wickedly provocative Lord Byron and is stunning, and Jeremy Irons is a terrifying Satan in an excerpt from Milton's Paradise Lost. Now, my long-term agent, long-term friend, and what I call my long-term good shepherd, Ed Victor, always believed in this project and has supported it from day one. So again, Ed, thank you. Now, why do we do all this? We believe that poetry is a trinity of sound and sense and sensibility. And the sound of sense will be lost unless we hear it. Language caught aloud. And as Frost said, the gold in the ore is the sound. Now, Seamus Heaney, when he was an undergraduate at Queen's, found reading four quartets for sight reading it for knowledge and joy, of course, and an intellectual experience. It wasn't until Robert Speight came to read at Queen's University out loud that four quartets became, as he said, forever hypnotic to him. Yeats in his 70s said that he'd spent his lifetime clearing out of poetry every phrase that had been written for the eye alone and bringing all back to context, which is for the ear alone. Now, Dame Eileen Atkins flew over specially for these readings, and she presents all those who introduce her with a serious problem. How does one list her achievements without staying up all night? So I am just going to list a number of her major awards. Best Actress Award for The Killing of Sister George, Variety Club Award for Vivat Vivat Regina, Olivia Best Actress for The Unexpected Man, Olivia Best Actress for Honor, Special Citation by the New York Drama Critics Circle for A Room of One's Own, Evening Standard British Film Award for her screenplay of Mrs. Dalloway, BAFTA Best Actress for BBC's Cranford, for which Eileen also won an Emmy and a Golden Globe nomination. And of course, over 20 years ago, we brought an Elliott programme into the West End, Let Us Go Then, You and I, we being Eileen, Edward Fox and Michael Goff, and we brought it into the Lyric in Shaftesbury Avenue, which is a very large theatre, and it was the first and only time a programme of pure poetry had a West End run. Now, there are some actors whose name on the credits, whether for a play, for television or film, or indeed audiobooks, he is regarded as the best in the business, incidentally, spells out perfection. Edward Herman is such an actor. He is an absolute master of his craft. Indeed, some of his performances present us with a masterclass in the art of acting. His brilliance has long been recognised. His FDR in Eleanor and Franklin brought universal acclaim. He won a Tony for his performance in Mrs. Warren's Profession and was nominated for a Tony in Philadelphia Story. His Emmy nominations include Saint Elsewhere, Concealed Enemies, and of course he won an Emmy for The Practice. I adored his performance as a ruthless and sexually obsessed Randolph Hearst in Peter Bogdanovich's The Cat's Meow. He starred with Al Pacino and Diane Weist in Oedipus the King and has just literally last night finished The Two Men of Florence at the Huntingdon Theatre. And of course, he won rave reviews of special interest tonight for his performance as T.S. Eliot in Tom and Viv. I can't thank Dame Eileen Atkins and Edward Herman enough. Their dedication is extraordinary, and I'm totally grateful. And finally, I hope this will not seem impertinent, we would ask you not to applaud until the very end of the performance. I am wholly dependent in these short introductions on the deep learning of other people. Tonight, most especially on the wonderful biography by Peter Ackroyd of T.S. Eliot, on C.K. Stead's astonishing insights into the soul of Eliot, and Professor Bernard Bergonzi, and the work of countless other essayists. And my errors, and I will make them, they are my own. I plead in defense, Dr. Johnson, who, when challenged as to an incorrect definition of a word in his dictionary, replied, "Ignorance, madam, pure ignorance." Eliot at Harvard. Quick description of a young man. He was a singularly attractive, tall, and rather dapper young man with a somewhat lambent smile. He went to dances, to parties, and he boxed. And he was about to write the glittering masterpiece with which we will open this evening's reading, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Now, Prufrock was the name of a hardware store in Eliot's hometown. It is regarded by many people as the first modern poem of the 20th century. It was written in fragments by a young man of 22, 23, and this is one of literature's more daunting truths, who was, according to his friend, the poet Conrad Aiken, heartlessly indifferent to its fate. Aiken and Ezra Pound fought to have it published. It was not an easy battle. It took 4 years. Some thought it completely insane. "Get on with it," said Ezra Pound to its first reluctant publisher, editor of poetry, a magazine of verse in Chicago. Now, why was there such difficulty in getting anyone to publish one of the greatest poems in the English language? Well, according to Hugh Kenner, Prufrock is a zone of consciousness. It's a zone of painfully acute sensitivity, the soul hovering between being and doing, one in which the symbol of reality, its associations and affinities rather than reality itself, dominates. Poetry, Eliot wrote, comes into being by the nature of that dark embryo within a poet which gradually takes on the form and speech of a poem. Now, where and how did Eliot, poet and man, come into being? He was born in St. Louis, Missouri in September 1808, a late son to older parents who already had five children. They were successful, practical Unitarians, part of the intellectual aristocracy of America, with strong family connections to Harvard, where one day, in the library, Eliot came across the book which he said changed his life. The title was Arthur Symons, The Symbolist Movement in Literature, an unlikely transformative title. Yet, in this book, Eliot found Laforgue, and in a sense, he found himself. Of such connections, Eliot wrote, these intimacies may pass. They are, however, ineffable. If Laforgue's was an art of the nerves, Eliot followed his nerves in Prufrock, that C.K. Stead's brilliant insight. After Harvard, his path seemed clear. He would become an academic. He rebelled, and he left for Paris. And from Harvard to Paris is not only a question of geography. That journey was followed by another, from Paris to Oxford's Merton College and to a darker personal destiny, marriage to Vivian Haig Wood. He was 27, good-looking, intelligent, with the diffidence which comes from pride or solitariness. She was good-looking, intelligent, with the high spirits which come from hysteria, Aykroyd's telling phrase. They married quickly. Eliot was unaware that Vivian suffered from a severe hormonal disorder, the appalling pain of which was alleviated in those days by morphine-based drugs, which in fact exacerbated her hysteria. The huge financial burden of doctors and sanatoria, which Eliot strove to meet, meant that for years he rarely worked fewer than 15 hours a day. 8 hours at Lloyd's Bank in London, in the evenings and weekends writing poetry and criticism, lecturing, editing, a schedule which improved only slightly when he became director at the publishers Faber and Geyers. It was then, later, of course, famously Faber and Faber. The stress of it almost broke his health, and it broke their marriage. After 18 years, he left Vivian. She was distraught. She refused to accept the inevitable, and a series of heartbreakingly bizarre, borderline dangerous incidents fueled by the drugs led to her to be confined for the last 11 years of her life to a mental institution. Eliot did not sign the papers. They, in fact, were divorced. He had no legal right to sign the papers. However, he never visited her. She died in 1947. It's a terrible tale, and compassion is the only correct response. Whether or not the haunting lines in Four Quartets concerning one of the gifts reserved for age, the knowledge of things ill done and done to others harm, which once you took for exercise of virtue, refer to his guilt over Vivian, and many people believe it, and they do, the statement quoted in collected letters edited by Valerie Eliot is unambiguous in relation to this marriage. He said, "This marriage, which brought to her no happiness, brought to me the state of mind out of which came the wasteland." So there was no creative dissonance in this terrible tragedy. This is from a letter, for example, to his editor. "I must wait for Vivian's opinion as to whether this section is printable." "Tom's mind," she said once. "I am Tom's mind." Valerie Fletcher brought late happiness to T.S. Eliot. They married, and the love that existed between them is celebrated for a very discreet man as he was in the joyful poem, A Dedication to My Wife, private words addressed to you in public. He was by then an iconic figure, feted everywhere he went. Viva, viva Eliot, they called to him in Rome. 14,000 people turned to hear him lecture in a football stadium in Minnesota on the frontiers of criticism. Those were the days. However, although there were his wonderful plays and essays, there was no more poetry. Larkin's rare bird had flown away. T.S. Eliot died in 1965, age 77, his wife Valerie at his side. After his death, she said, he felt he'd paid too high a price for poetry. The creation of art is a sacrifice of the man to the work. It is a kind of death, he said. We owe him. His ashes were taken to East Coker, from which his ancestors had departed. The opening and closing lines of the poem are engraved on his memorial. In my beginning is my end. In my end is my beginning. That line is prefigured less elegiacally in our second poem, Portrait of a Lady, the epigram from Marlowe's The Jew of Malta. Thou hast committed fornication, but that was in another country, and besides, the wench is dead. It was again written in fragments, and it's sometimes called the shortest one-act play in literature. There are three scenes, two characters. They're tea time conversations, which are politely, almost comically evasive, charged with possibility and hidden frustration and anger. The first, among the fog and smoke of a December afternoon. The second, with April sunsets, as the lady recalls her buried life. And of course, in Eliot, the buried life is an ever-recurring motif, a Jamesian refusal to live, which runs through almost all his work. The final meeting as an October night comes down and the lady confesses, I have been wondering frequently of late, but our beginnings never know our ends, why we have not developed into friends. Last lines, as John Donne tells us, are the stamp which give a poem currency. In this poem, as you will hear, they are ironic, yes. I think they're also very cruel. We end this section with Fragment of an Aegon. It's a conflict, incidentally, between characters and Greek tragedy, but there's nothing tragic in this piece, as during a card game late at night, the talk turns spookily to murder, and Sweeney, Eliot's everyman, who's got to use words when I talk to you, tells us that he knew a man once, did a girl in. But first, let us listen to the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent, to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed there will be time, for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes, there will be time. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create. And time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me. And time yet for 100 indecisions and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the chair, the stair, with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions which a minute will reverse. For I have known them already, known them all, have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room, so how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. And when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? And how shall I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl. And should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. And in the afternoon, the evening sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it toward some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all, that is not it at all. And would it have been worth it after all? Would it have been worthwhile? After the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this and so much more. It is impossible to say just what I mean. But as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns across a screen, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all, that is not what I meant at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. Am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince. No doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use. Politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse. At times, indeed, almost ridiculous, almost at times the fool. I grow old. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing, each to each. I do not think they will sing for me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves, blown back when the wind blows the water white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown. Portrait of a Lady. Among the smoke and fog of a December afternoon, you have the scene arrange itself, as it will seem to do, with...
I have saved this afternoon for you.
And four wax candles in the darkened room, four rings of light upon the ceiling overhead, an atmosphere of Juliet's tomb, prepared for all things to be said or left unsaid. We have been, let us say, to hear the latest Pole transmit the preludes through his hair and fingertips.
So intimate, this Chopin, that I think his soul should be resurrected only among friends. Mm. Some two or three who will not touch the bloom that is rubbed and questioned in the concert room.
And so the conversation slips among velleities and carefully caught regrets through attenuated tones of violins mingled with remote cornets and begins.
You do not know how much they mean to me, my friends, and how rare and strange it is to find in a life composed so much of odds and ends. For indeed I do not love it. You knew, you are not blind, how keen you are. To find a friend who has these qualities, who has and gives those qualities upon which friendship lives. How much it means that I say this to you. Without these friendships, life, what cauchemar.
Among the windings of the violins and the ariettes of cracked cornets, inside my brain a dull tom-tom begins, absurdly hammering a prelude of its own, capricious monotone, that is at least one definite false note. Let us take the air in a tobacco trance, admire the monuments, discuss the late events, correct our watches by the public clocks, then sit for half an hour and drink our box. Now that lilacs are in bloom, she has a bowl of lilacs in her room and twists one in her fingers while she talks.
Ah, my friend, you do not know what life is, you who hold it in your hands.
Slowly twisting the lilac stalks.
You let it flow from you. You let it flow. And youth is cruel and has no more remorse and smiles at situations which it cannot see.
I smile, of course, and go on drinking tea.
Yet with these April sunsets that somehow recall my buried life and Paris in the spring, I feel immeasurably at peace and find the world to be wonderful and youthful after all.
The voice returns like the insistent out of tune of a broken violin on an August afternoon.
I am always sure that you understand my feelings, always sure that you feel, sure that across the gulf you reach your hand. You are invulnerable. You have no Achilles heel. You will go on. And when you have prevailed, you can say, at this point, many a one has failed. But what have I? But what have I, my friend, to give you? What can you receive from me? Only the friendship and the sympathy of one about to reach her journey's end. I shall sit here, serving tea to friends.
I take my hat. How can I make a cowardly amends for what she has said to me? You will see me any morning in the park reading the comics and the sporting page. Particularly, I remark, an English countess goes upon the stage. A Greek was murdered at a Polish dance. Another bank defaulter has confessed. I keep my countenance. I remain self-possessed. Except when a street piano, mechanical and tired, reiterates some worn-out common song, with the smell of hyacinths across the garden, recalling things that other people have desired. Are these ideas right or wrong? The October night comes down, returning as before, except for a slight sensation of being ill at ease. I mount the stairs and turn the handle of the door and feel as if I had mounted on my hands and knees.
And so you are going abroad. And when do you return? But that's a useless question. You hardly know when you are coming back. You will find so much to learn.
My smile falls heavily among the bric-a-brac.
Perhaps you can write to me.
My self-possession flares up for a second. This is as I had reckoned.
I have been wondering frequently of late, but our beginnings never know our ends, why we have not developed into friends.
I feel like one who smiles and turning shall remark suddenly his expression in a glass. My self-possession gutters. We are really in the dark.
For everybody said so, all our friends. They all were sure our feelings would relate so closely. I myself can hardly understand. We must leave it now to fate. You will write at any rate. Perhaps it is not too late. I shall sit here serving tea to friends.
And I must borrow every changing shape to find expression. Dance, dance like a dancing bear. Cry like a parrot, chatter like an ape. Let us take the air in a tobacco trance. Well, and if what if she should die some afternoon? Afternoon, gray and smoky, evening, yellow and rose. Should die and leave me sitting pen in hand with the smoke coming down above the housetops, doubtful for a while, not knowing what to feel or if I understand or whether wise or foolish, tardy or too soon. Would she not have the advantage after all? This music is successful with a dying fall, now that we talk of dying. And should I have the right to smile? Fragment of an Aegon. Life is death. I knew a man once, did a girl in.
Oh, Mr. Sweeney, please don't talk. I cut the cards before you came and I drew the coffin. Mm. I drew the coffin, very last card. I don't care for such conversation. A woman runs a terrible risk.
I knew a man once, did a girl in. Any man might do a girl in. Any man has to, needs to, want to, once in a lifetime, do a girl. Well, he kept her there in a bath with a gallon of Lysol in the bath.
A woman runs a terrible risk.
This went on for a couple of months. Nobody came and nobody went, but he took in the milk and he paid the rent.
What did he do all that time? What did he do?
That don't apply. Talk to live men about what they do. He used to come and see me sometimes. I'd give him a drink and cheer him up.
Cheer him up?
Well, here again, that don't apply. But I've got to use words when I talk to you. But here's what I was going to say. He didn't know if he was alive and the girl was dead. He didn't know if the girl was dead and he was alive and he was dead. He didn't know if they were both alive or both were dead. If he was alive, then the milkman wasn't and the rent collector wasn't. And if they were alive, then he was dead. Well, there wasn't any joint. There wasn't any joint for when you're alone. When you're alone, like he was alone, you're either or neither. I'll tell you again, it don't apply. Death or life or death. Death is life. Life is death. I gotta use words when I talk to you. But if you understand or if you don't, that's nothing to me. Nothing to you. All we gotta do, we gotta do what we gotta do. We're gonna sit here and drink this booze. We're gonna stay and we're gonna go. And somebody's gotta pay the rent.
I know who.
When you're alone in the middle of the night and you wake in a sweat and a hell of a fright, when you're alone in the middle of the bed and you wake like someone hit you on the head and you've had a cream of a nightmare dream and you've got the hoo-ha's coming to you, hoo, hoo, hoo.
You dreamt you waked up at 7 o'clock and it's foggy and it's damp and it's dawn and it's dark and you wait for a knock or the turning of the lock, for you know the hangman's waiting for you and perhaps you're alive and perhaps you're dead.
Hoo-ha-ha.
Hoo-ha-ha.
Who?
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 Knock,
knock,
knock.
Knock,
knock,
knock.
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 It's quite a surprise from Mr. Elliot. Virginia Woolf to T.S. Eliot. We're not as good as Keats. T.S. Eliot to Virginia Woolf. Oh, yes, we are. We're trying something harder. Checkmate. He was indeed, and he succeeded. The Wasteland, published in October 1922, broke the mold in poetry, as Ulysses, published the same year, broke the mold in the novel. In the history of poetry, there is before and after Thomas Sterne's Eliot. There is before and after The Wasteland. His antecedents were the masters who changed the very nature of poetry. Ted Hughes said there is a direct line which could be drawn from Virgil to Dante, from Dante to Milton, and from Milton to Eliot, the greatest poet for over 300 years. Though Eliot described himself in less than radical terms as classical in literature, royalist in politics, and Anglo-Catholic in religion, he was, in fact, a great revolutionary. His work cuts into our consciousness with the sharpness of a diamond, according to the Nobel Prize Committee in 1948. Eliot would describe the Nobel Prize as a ticket to one's own funeral. The Wasteland, where is it? What is it? Well, as Eliot said, it is a state of mind. That state of mind still induces what Cyril Connolly described as the almost drugged and haunted condition it induced in students in 1922 as they gathered together to read it aloud. Edmund Wilson called it the great knockout up to date. Eliot has given them precisely the food they need, said E.M. Forster, at a time of post-war depression and exhaustion and the slow grief of Europe and Britain, which had seen a generation wiped out. It is not, however, an overtly political poem. I may have expressed, Eliot said, their own illusion of being disillusioned. It did not form part of my intention. The summer of 1921 was a summer of drought and severe influenza. Eliot was very ill and so exhausted he found it difficult to write at all. Yet something was building up in him from that dark embryo. Some forms of illness, fever or anemia, wrote Eliot, produce an efflux of poetry, the material incubating within the poet. It was Vivian who encouraged him to go to a sanatorium in Lausanne, and there The Wasteland was born. It was to have one of literature's most generous midwives, the amazing Ezra Pound, who on reading the poem wrote to Eliot, "Complimenty, you bitch. I am racked by the seven jealousies." Now, today, we were very lucky, and I know Paul earlier was saying of the treasures here, but we were extraordinarily lucky that Isaac Gerwitz took us into the archives, and we saw the original of The Wasteland, and we saw the amazing work that Ezra Pound did. He cut to the music, and he also cut many of the lines. In fact, Had it been done in red pencil, it almost would have resembled a piece of modern art. These are great treasures, and it's wonderful that they are here in this library, and we must learn that what we don't treasure, we will lose. Now, The Wasteland is dedicated, as it should be, to Ezra Pound, Il migliore fabbro, the better craftsman. The critics, alas, again, almost all attacked it. Even though some of course, praised it and saw how marvelous it was, many thought it was actually a hoax. They missed completely the revolutionary nature of this symbolist poem, the ultimate exemplar of Eliot's auditory imagination, which he described as follows: the feeling for syllable and rhythm penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word, sinking to an origin, and bringing something back, fusing the most ancient and most civilized mentalities. The original title was He'd Do the Police in Different Voices, Betty Higden's phrase from Dickens' Our Mutual Friend. You mightn't think it, But Sloppy is a beautiful reader of a newspaper. He do the police in different voices. Eliot do the wasteland in different voices, which rise from far below the conscious thought, to sing out to us in fragmentary stories of their lives. These fragments I have stored against my ruins. Lines of gender are blurred in their strange, broken visions, which incorporate lines from Ovid, Dante, Shakespeare, Jacobean tragedy, Sanskrit texts, the Bible, occasionally using jazz rhythms. Now, Ralph Ellison said of The Wasteland that it was closer to jazz than the work of Negro poets. And as Larkin noted, jazz is as close to the unconscious as we can get. They sing raucous popular songs, then switch suddenly to the formality of Elizabethan language or the incantations of a prayer. The epigram to the poem is from Petronius's Satyricon. For I myself once saw with my own eyes the Sibyl hanging in a cage. And when the boys asked her, "Sibyl, what do you want?" she answered, "I want to die." Part one, The Burial of the Dead, opens with the voice of an aristocratic woman vehemently denying that she is Russian. "I am German, pure German." She recalls a lullaby from childhood from Tristan and Isolde. "Fresh blows the wind from the homeland, my Irish child, where are you dwelling?" Her life is now barren. "I read much of the night and go south in the winter." Visions, apocalyptic, of waste and empty sea, and of course, fear in a handful of dust from Evelyn Waugh took that line, of course, and used it in the novel. Suddenly, we hear the voice of Madame Sesostris, who is a wicked pack of cards. Then, the unreal city, Baudelaire's city of dreams, and a crowd flowed over London Bridge. "I had not thought death had undone so many." That haunting line is followed by the strange, almost savage query to Stetson about the corpse he planted last year in his garden. And the last line from Baudelaire's Fleur du Mal is a contemptuous challenge to us, the hypocrite reader, my likeness, my brother. Part two, A Game of Chess, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door, from Middleton's A Game at Chess. The opening section, believed to represent his marriage to Vivian, begins in the room, which is heavy with her strange synthetic perfumes, and a Barbus's line from Cleopatra. Suddenly, the jagged voice of an hysterical woman breaks in. "My nerves are bad tonight." "Yes, bad. It's frightening and sad. But Vivian wrote in the margins, wonderful, wonderful." Then the note changes abruptly, and we're in a Cockney pub to hear of poor Albert out on leave, and he wants a good time, and of Lil, who ought to be ashamed, she looks so antique. It's closing time, and the landlord calls out repeatedly, "Hurry up, please, it's time." The meaning of the line is multi-layered, and fades away in Ophelia's echoing salutation, "Good night, ladies, good night, sweet ladies, good night. Good night." Part three, The Fire Sermon, refers to Buddha's fire sermon, which Eliot considered as important as the Sermon on the Mount. In this section, Tiresias, the conjunction of man and woman, key character in the poem, Eliot tells us, is blind witness to the casual seduction by the young man carbuncular as lovely woman stoops to folly. Then, as the river sweats oil and tar, Elizabeth and Leicester are carried downstream to the peal of bells. We hear the Rhine maidens from Götterdämmerung, and then our lovely fallen woman speaks of resignation. What should I resent? The poem ends with St. Augustine's cry as he came to Carthage, burning with unholy loves. Part four, Death by Water, admonishes us to remember Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. Part five, What the Thunder Said, contains what Eliot believed was his best poetry, the water dripping song, taken from his childhood memories of the hermit water thrush in his New England home. "Who is the third who walks always beside you, refers to an illusion in extreme conditions, where believed to be Shackleton's, that there's always one more walking beside you than has been counted. The last lines, data, give, dadavam, sympathize, and amyata, control, are followed by shanti, 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 which means the peace which passeth understanding. I believe this poem is one of the triumphs of literature and of life. So, to the wasteland.
The burial of the dead. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Binga keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Murray, Murray, hold on tight, and down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in. Under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du? You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak, and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence. Oot. Und leer das Meer. Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold. Nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. Here, said she, is your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Look. Here is Belladonna, the lady of the rock. The lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel, and here is the one-eyed merchant, and this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs short and infrequent were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him crying, Stetson, you who were with me in the ships at Mylai, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? Or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère.
A game of chess. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass, held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out, another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branched candelabra reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it, from satin cases poured in rich profusion. In vials of ivory and colored glass, unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered, or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned the sense in odors. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the liquaria, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling. Huge sea wood fed with copper burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone, in which sad light a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantel was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene the change of Philomel by the barbarous king so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, jug, jug, to dirty ears. And other withered stumps of time were told upon the walls. Staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room and closed. Footsteps shuffled on the stair. Under the firelight, under the brush, her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still.
My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think.
I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones.
What is that noise?
The wind under the door.
What is that noise now? What is the wind doing?
Nothing. Again, nothing.
Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing?
I remember those are pearls that were his eyes.
Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head?
But, oh, that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent.
What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do?
The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4. And we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door.
When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself,
hurry up, please, it's time.
Now Albert's coming back, make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did, I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set, he said. I swear I can't bear to look at you. I know, Ma, can't I, I said. And think of poor Albert. He's been in the army 4 years, he wants a good time. And if you don't give it him, there's the will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. Then I'll know who to thank, she said, and give me a straight look.
Hurry up, please, it's time.
If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique, and her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already and nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What you get married for if you don't want children?
Hurry up, please, it's time.
Well, that Sunday Albert was home, they had a hot gammon, and they asked me in to dinner to get the beauty of it hot.
Hurry up, please, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time.
Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night. Ta-da. Good night. Good night.
Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night.
The fire sermon. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed. And their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. By the waters of Leman I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank while I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening round behind the gas house, musing upon the king my brother's wreck and on the king my father's death before him. White bodies naked on the low, damp ground, and bones cast in a little, low, dry garret, rattled by the rat's foot only, year to year. But at my back, from time to time, I hear the sound of horns and motors, which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash their feet in soda water. Et aux ces voix d'enfants chantant dans la coupole. Twit, 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 chug, 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 so rudely forced, terroux.
Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole.
At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window, perilously spread, her drying combinations, touched by the sun's last rays, on the divan are piled, at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives. A small house agent's clerk, with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended, she is bored and tired, endeavors to engage her in caresses which still are unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once, exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response, and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have forsuffered all, enacted on this same divan or bed, I who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover, Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass.
Well, now, that's done, and I'm glad it's over.
When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone.
This music crept by me upon the waters, along the Strand, up Queen Victoria Street. Oh, city, city, I can sometimes hear, beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin, and a clatter and a chatter from within, where fishmen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendor of Ionian white and gold.
The river sweats, oil and tar. The barges drift with the turning tide. Red sails wide to leeward swing on the heavy spar. The barges wash drifting logs down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs. Wala la lea, wala la le la la. Elizabeth and Leicester, beating oars, the stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold. The brisk swell rippled both shores. Southwest wind carried downstream the peal of bells, white towers. Wala la lea, wala la lea la la.
Trams and dusty trees. Highbury bore me, Richmond and Kew undid me. By Richmond I raised my knees, supine on the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Moorgate and my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? On Margaret Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. The broken fingernails of dirty hands. My people, humble people, who expect nothing. La la.
To Carthage then I came, burning, 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 burning. O Lord, thou pluckest me out. O Lord, thou pluckest, burning.
Death by water. Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls and the deep sea's swell and the profit and loss. A current under sea picked his bones in whispers. As he rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you.
What the thunder said. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and place and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying, with a little patience. Here is no water, but only rock. Rock and no water, and the sandy road. The road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock one cannot stop or think sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock. if there were the sound of water only, not the cicada and dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. But there is no water.
Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together, but when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded, I do not know whether a man or a woman. But who is that on the other side of you? What is that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains, cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall, and upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours, and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells.
In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing over the tumbled graves. About the chapel, there is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. It has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico, in a flash of lightning. Then a damp gust bringing rain. Ganga was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himavant. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. Then spoke the thunder, Da!
Dutta. What have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. By this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries, or in memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Da.
Dayadvam. I heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, thinking of the key. Each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Da. Damyata. The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to the controlling hands. I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. Poisa cosa nel foco, che glia fina, quando fianco Celidon. O swallow, swallow, le prince d'Aquitaine à la tour abolie. These fragments have I shored against my ruins. Why then I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again.
Dutta.
Dayadvam.
Damyata.
Shanti.
Shanti. Shanti. Shanti. Shanti.